Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I am with Matthew Rice, an illustrator whose work is probably in more houses in the UK than any other, with his fabulous pictures of birds, flowers, dogs adorning the famous Emma Bridgewater mugs, and more, a business which he ran with his ex-wife Emma. Matthew was chairman of the company until 5 years ago. You are a most famous illustrator. Your whole style is a sort of ethos of the countryside, of plants, of flowers and gardens. So when I look at a tea towel, a mug, or whatever that you've designed, I immediately think that you must have your roots well grounded in the soil.
That's very nice. I think that if you design things that you don't know about, you end up with a fairly bloodless kind of designing. And an awful lot of stuff is like that. People say, yes, we're going to do Navajo this week. And it you know, it's all unfelt. And so definitely, yes, I basically am fairly stolid. I hang on in the areas that I understand, which is animals, gardens and flowers.
And so where did you get this ingrained adoration of them? I mean, was it as a child, very young?
Yes, I mean, I always liked animals. And I was a really rubbish teenager. The years I should have spent doing the things that teenagers are supposed to do, I was growing broad beans and doing cuttings.
How cool is that now?
I think not, but I'm trying to be more teenagerish now where possible. But I think I really took to it then as being something I loved. I mean, I've always loved growing stuff, and I'd always loved having chickens and doing animals. Mm. So this is just a sort of full-on expression of that enthusiasm.
But your mother, Pat Albeck, so she was a very well-known illustrator. Tea towel queen, called her.
Yes, they did. No, I mean, I always thought about her. I remember someone saying once I'd recognise my mother's cooking anywhere. And I thought, actually, I knew my mother's line anywhere, you'd see. And she really did have something in everybody's house. I mean, in everybody's caravan and everybody's kitchen, she produced hundreds and hundreds of tea towels, a lot of them for the National Trust, a lot of furnishings for John Lewis, endless different bits of sort of domestical pattern. She was a great pattern designer. So, yes, I picked it up from there.
Right. And then your father, Peter Rice, was a very well-known stage designer and also dressed. He did costumes
for
the plays.
I think I could honestly say that that's one of the bits I didn't inherit.
So you went to Bedales.
Yeah.
An old Bedalian, are they called?
They are called that, yes.
A very sort
all of old school names, always absolutely ridiculous sounding to anyone who wasn't there, and seemed totally normal if you went, of course.
But I always imagined, I don't know many from Bedales, I have to say, but I always imagined it was
really
very
nice. You ought to meet more.
Very expressive, encouraging to do your own thing, lots of art. Artists, aren't there? Lily Allen, when you think of cart pass ones.
Yeah, no, I think it was a place that certainly encouraged creative expression.
Yeah.
But mainly, I think it was I'm inclined to be a bit of an advertisement for it, as I went on to chair the board for years and everything, so I got quite stuck into it.
And you sent your kids there?
And I sent three of my four children there. It's absolutely terrible for sport. And so my eldest daughter, who's an acrobat, didn't think it would be the right place for her. But in general, I think it's a place where you should be able to make something of what you're good at, not struggle with something you're bad at.
And I imagine it had amazing gardens. Am I right there or not?
No, I don't think it did. Oh. In fact, one of the things I did when I went back to start doing governing was to start trying to get the gardening going again. Because I think it had been all right, but it had got very, very scrappy and sort of old people's homish.
Right.
And, you know, those shrubs that get clipped every year into a sort of circle, whatever they are, because that's what you do with shrubs.
You're usually paid by the bucket of trimmings.
Paid by the stuff that goes away, exactly. And we did, by the time I left, there were some jolly nice borders going, and I was a great one for ordering a whole load of exciting plants to come and tart it up.
But you didn't put it, when you were governor, you didn't say, why don't we teach horticulture? Why don't we get them?
Do you know, there's a bit there called outdoor work, which is absolute. I mean, I've definitely always championed it, but it's a really important part of the syllabus, this idea of, if you're Cheltenham, we don't play rugby, but if you're not brilliant at sport, then you've got to be doing something else outside in the afternoon. And so there are cows, Dexters, you were pleased to hear.
Oh, good.
A small herd of Dexters, yes. Sheep, pigs, all that kind of thing, and so goats even. So the idea of a sort of school farm is quite central to the place, and it's visually very, it's a very significant part of it. You know, when you go around, there are Jacob's sheep in the paddocks and everything there. So yes, I had chickens there too. I had a lot of bantams when I was at school.
Right.
Sold eggs to the teachers.
Oh gosh, it's impressive. So, and then you went on from there. You were a chippy or a carpenter or what would you call it?
I think if anyone has seen anything I ever did, no, I was at school with my friend David Linley, and he and I did a furniture business. He was definitely the chippy and carpenter. I was the drawer of designs.
He wasn't really a chippy, though. He was a cabinet maker.
He was a cabinet maker. Yeah, we don't call it chippy. You're absolutely right. He was a fine cabinet maker. I would be less than a chippy. He was definitely, is still very good at making things. And I did that for a bit, yes.
And what bit did you do?
I just did the design. I did the designing as
well. Right. Oh,
Which I mean, I think if you like designing, then... I don't think I'd be very good at designing a car or anything that had
space
to work.
Space rockets.
Really poor.
Yeah.
But I probably do. I love doing furniture or doing buildings or doing other things as well.
So your watercolouring, though, came, I read, is this right, you were given a fine ream of watercolour paper. I've done my research.
No, you really have. You found it all out. Well, there was a my godmother, who was called Verity, had a friend called Ethne. I mean, you couldn't make it up, really. And Ethne had a husband who shall remain nameless because we have no idea what he was called. And when Ethne's husband turned turtle, Ethne, said to Verity, what shall I do with this lovely paper? And she said, oh, why don't you give it to my godson Matthew? So I landed this unbelievable 50-year-old ream of very thick watercolour paper, and it kind of set me on the way to watercolours being what I was going to do. And it's my medium. I understand it really fully.
I don't know a lot about watercolours, but your colours do seem very intense and very strong. You know, a lot of them are fairly wishy-washy, but yours have gusto.
Yes, I'm not very good at those Russell Flint ladies with sort of watery bosoms lying down on the sofa. I do like a bold block of colour, bold wash. I think that you can do really strong colours. And there's a painter called Edward Burrough, who's my kind of hero watercolourist, or Cotman, or Patrick Proctor, all sorts of people who use watercolour as a strong material, strong medium. And yeah, I love it. Yesterday I went and bought a whole load of new pans. It's my sort of favourite thing. It's endless sweets for me, is going and finding a new purple or something like that that you might add, and just see whether it would change what you were doing. You always think it changes. Of course, nothing changes as much as you hope. But.
And so when your ex-wife started, or you started the Bridgewater Pottery together, it was very small to start with, obviously. It started out quite small, and then it grew with sort of sales of over 33 million or so.
Extraordinary.
Phenomenal growth. No, I mean, to your design.
Well, I don't know. She started it. She hadn't met me, so I'd love to claim I'd started
it
with her. But it definitely got established without the faint pleasure of meeting me. But we did go into working together for about 30 years. And I still do a lot of the designing now for it. It's incredibly nice. I think if you're a designer, possibly the biggest privilege you could hope for is to control what happens to what you do. So to be able to design for a technique and a system that you understand, so you're not just sending little drawings out into the ether and saying, oh, I wonder what happens to these little patterns, is a huge treat, and it's been marvellous. But yes, the business grew from nothing, because everything starts quite nothingy, and is very successful now and sells all over the place. It's brilliant.
Sold many mugs to my sister, who used to send her husband a personalised mug every year with sort of the best husband, red hot lover, all things emblazoned on them. And then when they got divorced, they all hit the ground.
Yeah, my sister, obviously a lady of extraordinarily good taste, whatever the husband was like. But I'm sorry that the mugs ended up getting destroyed, but I hope she marries again and the habit starts off afresh.
Yes, she must rekindle that idea.
Yes, it's a good one. She shouldn't blame the mugs. I think the important thing is to keep that bit running on.
So with those mugs, I mean, I can't imagine there's a house in this country without a mug. I mean, do you think you do supply with your celebration mugs? Was it how many hundreds of thousands of
that was extraordinary. Yes,
Queen's mugs?
Because I think it's unusual to make everything in England. I think there's a particular sort of synergy with Bridgewater with Royal Commemoration.
Yeah.
Because the Royal Commemoration thing, you kind of do want it to be made in England, I think.
Mm.
And so, yes, we sold, I don't know, tens of thousands, possibly more. And I loved doing them. Mm. In fact, when the late Queen died, I was in Rome and we did all the initial designing on the telephone. I'd got a very, very inexpensive hotel.
You and the Queen on the telephone?
No. She had already gone to heaven. I was talking to Emma on the telephone. I'd got a very cheap hotel room. And I saw there was a desk, which I thought, well, I'll work on there. And I actually had to sort of sit backwards on the bed. That's a position for radio. I had to sit sort of on the side of the bed, poking forward, in order to use a sort of 9-inch long desk. And then we zapped designs back and forth between each other because we wanted to get going with those things.
Yeah, God, amazing, really good. And which is your favourite mug? I mean, you must have hundreds of Emma Bridgewater mugs, and which is the one that you like the best?
You could never have enough, I hasten to add. I have got a couple of hundred different designs myself, and we have done, Emma has produced hundreds and hundreds. I really love the ones with birds on and flowers on. There was a simple bird in repeat, and we've done about 100 birds and probably about 60 plant ones, flower ones. And I think they're very nice because they, I hope, resonate for people. So if it's a kind of dog or if it's a flower someone loves, it's quite an easy present. But also I hope that they do say blue tit or wagtail or camellia or whatever in such a way that people feel strongly about them.
The one you did for Horatio's Garden for the Olivia was thrilled.
I know. We've done two or three for them, and this last one had apple blossom, and we've done several.
Yeah,
it's such an amazing charity. Again, we seem to be a good mix.
Of excellent fit.
We seem to be a good fit. That's actually what I mean. Yeah.
So back to your garden here. So you started this from scratch. I mean, it's a wonderful medieval building, isn't it? Sitting over there. And when you got it, it was nothing like this, but you realised its full potential.
I'm sure I haven't done that, but it is true.
In your mind's eye, you realised
what
it could
do. Yeah, I think that I had... We bought it 10 years ago, and it was a farm, quite run down, and most of the site inside what had been the original moated castle site was taken up with big concrete and steel buildings.
Mm.
And so the first thing was to sort of be able to think about getting rid of them.
Mm.
And so we did a lot of demolition and a lot of clearing. I think our predecessor, who was a tenant of Jesus College, had made quite a business of accepting builders' waste for £10 a load. So some areas were just completely covered in old bits of rubbish. I mean, it was extraordinarily challenging. Some people, friends of ours, came here and literally burst into tears at the project we were taking on. But the garden has been, in some ways, it's rather nice not to have a garden there, not have to go, do we keep this or get rid of this? Because, I mean, the garden we're standing in now, will you be quiet? That's a small chihuahua singing. That's a sound that only a small, cookie, be quiet, chihuahua will make. The sort of enclosure we're in here was one building. So the bit within this wall here, that was another building. There was a huge barn behind there. The whole of that area there was another barn. So there were about six large buildings here, and everything was concrete. So there was also no soil. Mm. When saying starting from scratch, one had to invent the whole thing. In fact, when we started that kitchen garden there, great diggers appeared, and the thing was dug out, and muck and soil and topsoil put in. The one thing no one had thought of was drainage. The effect of that, with a rather high water table in gravel, was that the entire garden full of muck and soil rose gradually during the winter.
Mm.
And then we realised we had to take it all out again and put drains in.
Wow.
Now there are drains.
So the water table is quite high?
Yes, I don't think...
Because the river level seemed a bit lower. Was you come over the lovely river.
We're on the highest bit right here.
Yeah.
But yes, if you dig, it's about 4 foot. It's quite high. And we're in... this is the Thames Valley, Upper Thames Valley, or sort of middle Upper Thames Valley. And this particular bit was all riverbed, it's all gravel. And when we were redigging the moat, amongst other things, we found a sort of mammoth's tusk, which the archaeologists couldn't have cared less about because they're single interest and mammoths are not archaeological. But we did. I did ask someone who was a mammoth enthusiast and said, so does that mean that there were mammoths wandering around in the riverbed there? And they said, no, they probably were in Swindon and came downstream. No one's ever called Swindon City of Mammoths. And it might be the secret to its success in some ways. But I also, obviously, when you dig in a... Sorry, what I didn't explain was that this remnant of this house is the last little bit of a medieval castle. It was built in 1320 by a great magnate of Edward II's court called Aymer de Valence, who was Lord Pembroke. And he started building it and then died very quickly. He was kidnapped on a mission to see the Pope in Avignon and bankrupted by the ransom and then died when he got back. So probably it was never all that much built, but there is a gatehouse and nice stonework and vaults. And that's the sort of basis of this, which was why we decided to redig a moat, so as to try and get a feeling of castleness.
Yeah. And then you set about working on the garden, creating the garden here. So it was, the footprint was made up with the buildings that were here, basically. And you've built new walls around it.
Yes. I mean, you're always sort of jealous when you go to someone's house and they didn't have to build the walls. Because, I mean, the walls are a nightmare to build, incredibly expensive. All those breeze blocks, all that stone, all that brick, all those tiles, all those things. But yes, so and they don't exactly correlate to the buildings, but I mean, like everybody else, one wants a series of rooms. I've actually smashed one of the walls down between the two rooms in here. There was a huge hedge dividing this two-garden bit, but it was home. And I now feel rather awful saying it, but it was home to all the worst mammal pests you could possibly have in your garden. And you were so nice as to compliment me on the size of my celeriac earlier. But when the hedge was there, you would approach a celeriac with enthusiastic hunger, and in you'd find it was just an empty shell with two little voles curled up in the middle having a sleep. And and eventually I thought the hedge, that bit of hedge in the garden, which I did plant, is going to have to go elsewhere. It's been resituated and repurposed. But I decided we couldn't have hedge in the middle of the kitchen garden. Too much of a reservoir of naughtiness.
And so you do gardening courses here?
I do a lot of painting courses here. I have a vague idea I might do a little vegetable gardening course because I've done it for so long and some people haven't done it at all.
I must say your vegetables are amazing. I literally have never seen such big celeriac. And we have, is it Tom, a big farmer near us in Lincolnshire, and he grows thousands, yes. And he's trying to popularise it. And yours are whoppers.
One of my daughters said one of the worst disappointments in the world is when you look at what looks like dauphinoise and you find it's celeriac.
Oh, it's half the calories.
That's probably why no one likes it quite so much. I love it. I think it's marvellous.
Great in
and you
raw.
Can do all that remoulade and all
it's so lovely.
I think that people are confused a little bit. Some bits are just easier to show than to write about. A friend of mine who was totally new to gardening decided she would set herself up with a new garden, and she bought a lot of seed trays and compost and seeds, and she had a lovely conservatory in which to do it. And she said, could you come and have a look at these seeds? Because they've all come up and died. And I thought maybe they'd damped off or something. So I drove round, and each tray had an imperceptibly thin level of compost in it. And almost like a dusting on the floor, and on top of that were some dead seedlings. And I said, but you haven't put any compost. She said, I've done exactly what it says. It said, plant 1/4 inch deep in compost. And I think it is important sometimes to show people directly, because, I mean, she was entirely right. She followed the instructions as on the packet. She just followed them wrong. I am going to do a bit of that as well.
No, and it was mainly vegetables, or I imagine you had acres of peonies and irises and mugs.
There is an iris bed and everything else. I mean, irises are that difficult thing because you mix them up with everything else and then you have a frightful mess. But then you have an iris bed and it's heavenly for 4 weeks, and then it's the most desperate place in the garden. I have all the way down the far side of my greenhouse is an iris bed, and it has a good moment. But then you get the glooms after that and you have to walk away. From the irises. But no, I think vegetables I love most because I love cooking and I love doing it. But I love flowers to pick, and I'm not very good on greenery and whitery. I like My father, who
but
was
you've got structure.
Like
you say that, but you've got box hedges and lavender hedges and lots of topiary yew.
Yes, well, that's very green, isn't it?
Yeah, very green. So there's a fair bit of structure.
Oh, right, there's a bit of structure. And walls. Yeah. I wish I'd done more non-expensive structure. The walls are a costly approach to it compared to hedge, but they are warm and nice.
Yes.
And although I have made little holes in them for birds to nest in, which birds are unbelievably generous in saying, yes, we'll use it. But you don't have quite so much in the way of voles in a wall. Mm. Well, not in these ones, anyway.
That's true. So you are pretty self-sufficient, are you? I mean, we had amazing radicchio for lunch and lettuce. So how self-sufficient are you, would you say?
Well, quite. I mean, there's a sort of golden moment, I think, in February and March when you're allowed to go to the greengrocers. And you just think, gosh, how lovely. Oxford, this is my nearest place for good greengrocers, has two marvellous greengrocers. And I breathe out in a great relaxed sigh and you can go and have lovely imported vegetables. But yes, I think I've got a polytunnel and it's the secret weapon of self-sufficiency because everything starts 5 weeks earlier, so you're picking broad beans in April. Slightly, the polytunnel is like Tuscany thrown into your garden. Mm. It's just, everything is just that. Your sweet peas are April, not May. Your sugar snaps are very early April. You can just really help stuff along in there.
So how many hours a week are you spending in the garden, would you say?
It varies. So I would like to say I was a single-handed operative, but I'm not. I've got, I suppose, the equivalent of one full-time person and a bit more, and then I mean, you do a lot if it's yours, and you get a lot done. I think so. I probably spend a day and a half, I should think myself. But in the summer, I do it because you can do it so late, so nice. You can start work at 5 and get 5 hours in. Now, you've got to pinch off the rest of the day. I mean, I do paint at night. One thing I learnt from my parents was that after dinner, you go back to work. I mean, it was extraordinary. They would have dinner at about. My father would come down at 7:30 for a drink and a crossword, and then they'd have dinner, and then my father would pour a glass of whiskey, and my mother wouldn't, and they'd go back to their desks, and my mum would work till about 11:30, and my father till 1 or 2.
And what time did they get up in the morning?
My father was late as possible.
Oh, so he's just...
I mean, nine or 9:30. My mother just didn't sleep so much. I don't sleep very much in the summer. I'm quite a good champion sleeper this time of year.
And the light is okay? You find for watercolours, or you don't do those
bits? No, you don't do those bits, you do the drawing bit. Right. No, because it is true, you can do some jolly dingy colour, and sometimes I send something across to Emma to show what I'm doing, and said, don't do any more painting in the night. Just do the line work, don't do the painting, because one can get a bit murky at night.
Yeah.
And I have got actually a great bank of daylight bulbs in one of the places I work, but it's cheerless light to be in the evening. At that point, depression can overcome efficiency. So I think there's always plenty of other things to do.
And so your top gardening tips, if you were doing your gardening course here,
yes.
What do you think you've learned? Because I do find that gardening books are very prescriptive and everyone is very different in their approach. And I'm sure you've developed some great techniques here, have you? Well, your solera, you said you started off in
cells.
February.
I tell you what.
In cells, well, yes. So and that is the
I think
secret,
when you start
it?
Stuff is really interesting. And I think that, and that goes the whole way through the summer. I'm always aware, 27th of July, for one of my children's birthdays, very, very good day, always, to sow the last of everything, last French beans, last courgettes. It's really late, but they'll all make it through in the middle of September. And just when everything, every courgette is looking a bit ratty and hard
you're
and
long, coming on.
You've got a whole load of new ones. Just when your French beans are a little bit horny around the edges, you've got lovely, crisp new ones.
I go later and than you.
Even later.
But that is probably because I'm on the east, and so we do have more intense
Everything's
heat.
Better on the east, we all know
that.
It's a well-known fact. This is a frightful cold spot here because we're slap bang in the middle of England. It would take about a week to get to the sea in any direction.
Yes.
So when we had that very cold weather last year, we were -9 for 7 days or something.
No, we were low. We are cold, extreme, colder and
but
hotter.
But you do get a bit more baking. I mean, it's not the last sowing I do. I then do September stuff for all those...
Winter lettuce and all that kind of thing.
But I have, on the other hand, finally given in to the fact that just doing everything really early isn't always good. So I used to be a fanatically early tomato grower and want to always have tomatoes in June and all the rest of it. But unless your greenhouse, whole greenhouse, is heated, There's no point getting marvellous plants in the middle of April that are 18 inches high, because if they're going to go out and they're going to be etiolated, and they're just not going to be able to really deal with the relative cold of going down to 6 and 7 at night.
No,
so I've kind of given in to the idea that you do things in the beginning of March. I mean, not everything, but I think that things like tomatoes, which I would do. I mean, so aubergines and peppers, fair enough. They're so you can hold them back and they'll build lovely root systems. But tomatoes are so jolly runaway bride-ish about the whole thing that I think that it's better to wait a bit. So I've learnt to do that. I've learnt to keep tomato. I saw on the Instagram a lady in Bosnia with amazing tomatoes. She disappeared. I hope she's doing it quietly on her own somewhere. But I said how lovely they are, and she sent me some seeds of these extraordinarily delicious, long, pear-shaped, red, pinky-red tomatoes. And I've run them with two friends of mine, and I have now run them for 5 years from those seeds and just kept them going. And that's, I love doing that. And I never know whether it's strictly speaking allowed, but I do like it when you go abroad and you come back with some strange and odd seed.
Yes.
Some of the plants, the varieties people go for, everyone says supermarkets only grow the things that last, but actually garden centres slightly inclined to have Moneymaker and Shirley for their tomatoes, Gardener's Delight and Sungold. And if you like cherries, the latter two are good, but the other two are desperately dreary.
Absolutely.
All that work to grow a whole greenhouse full of tomatoes, and then they taste less good than the ones in a co-op.
Yeah, no,
nothing wrong with the co-op tomatoes, I hasten to add. Yeah. But there's no point in doing all that work. And I think getting those, trialing all those varieties, and it's why the people who do good seed catalogues do all that trialing properly, because it really does make a massive difference. And the investment in time is so big.
And in America, they've got wonderful ones as well, haven't they? In Italy, in places.
And tomatoes and pumpkins in America, they knock us right out of the soil. They're so good. And they're, you know, there's something called the Tomato Club, or was, where it has sort of 800 tomato varieties. It's obviously a baffling way to spend an evening trying to choose some, but a sort of eeny, meeny, miny, mo method seems to work fine. And also, they've always got names like sort of Tartan Jimmy's Orange Sporran or something.
And, well, you'd go for
and,
that.
And they always go for that every time and try and go for one of the less likely ones. I got a appallingly named squash in California last year called Long Pink Banana. But Long Pink Banana is one of the most delicious pumpkins I've ever grown. And it looks like a sort of spaghetti marrow, but it's pale salmon pink. And you cut it in half and cook it. And it's the most delicious thing in the world.
And is the skin quite tough still?
The skin's very tough on those. Yes. I mean, it's a winter squash, not a summer one. But I went to a lovely pumpkin squash farm in Northern California, and they had this great sort of trailer heaped high. One of them was called That Old Warty One. That Old Warty One, I have to say, has not been a wild success here. Maybe it requires some better American weather to get its warts going properly. But the Long Pink Banana, that's a winner.
Yeah, it is all about trialling, and being much more international, you pick up these wonders, don't you? The other thing I can never understand with people growing tomatoes is they rip out the plants in sort of October, but mine will often go on fruiting till December with no heat.
Well, I did also this year at Chelsea, there was a stand, Burpee from Hull in England.
The black American tomato, was it?
No, this was a plain tomato, and it said, and I said, well, this is very nice to see these seeds, but I don't think I can bother to buy tomato seeds for next year. And she said, oh no, they're for now. And so they went in on May the 24th or something, and I've just stopped picking them now, almost in December, and they didn't start till October.
Oh, right.
And they were youthful, young tomato plants in October because they were started
so
eight
late.
Weeks late. And they weren't the most delicious I've ever grown, but they were quite nice and they were in good nick. Mm. There is a tomato I'm mad for, which is called Big Rainbow, which is low yield of fruits, but probably average weight. And they're big. They're nearly a kilogram size, big tomatoes.
Whoa.
And on the outside, they're yellowy orange. And inside, they're kind of slightly... I'm sure a catalogue would say blushed, but we would call it blotched, slightly red inside. And they are the best tasting tomato I've ever grown. You don't get more than 3 or 4 off a plant, but gosh, they're good.
A kilogram?
I think they're £2 tomatoes, some of them.
Wow.
And they are called Big Rainbow. And so that's definitely my tomato tip.
gosh, I will grow that next year.
And it's definitely worth getting it. I think I got it. I mean, I've seen it in different places, but it's a very nice tomato.
A client of mine in Japan grew a tomato, and it was one plant, and they had it in this house, and they grew it, and they got 10,000 tomatoes from it.
No.
And they gave it, you know, great, obviously,
but
the sunlight.
Were they teeny-weeny ones or not?
No, they were a decent size. I mean, they didn't side-shoot it. They didn't do anything to it but feed it and keep it warm. And it was a mammoth, you know. So all this business about side-shooting and things.
But do you not side-shoot then?
Yeah, I do side-shoot. Yes. But it was massive. It was like a tree.
Yes, I mean, I do because I'm a bit power-crazed and control-freaky, and I like to see them being all nice and neat and coordinate. But I am aware that you can just let... they can do perfectly well with a little bit less of that.
Yeah,
treatment.
And this time of year, mine have just gone wild and they're still producing.
It's
and
interesting.
I'll go
so
on
mine,
till December.
Mine aren't. I've left all their roots in, but mine, I took the last lot out last week.
But was it because they're untidy and you're tidy?
No, no, no. They'd
it was
literally
just they
gone
literally had
brown.
Nothing on them.
And anyway, they'd all turned into ranunculuses now instead. because you could polytunnel three, you could get three lots of things.
Yes.
So the tomatoes come out and. Well, you can, two and a half, I suppose you can get. And I've got about half the poly has got stuff in it at the moment. So there's lots of spring greens and collards and sort of different things that will do that will do winter stuff. And then there's an amazingly lovely Calabrese called something awful like Green Magic or something, which is, you start not quite yet, but which is also a really nice early one. But the sugar snaps are going out probably this week and broad beans are going into it.
Yes.
And... I might even be bold and put some sweet peas in it now. But my tomatoes did eventually just give up the ghost, I suppose, end of October. The other thing, which is a good poly thing for those with polys, which I learnt from a friend of mine, is I put two peach trees, and I cannot tell you the number of peaches 2 years on that we were, I think probably 80 peaches from each tree.
Mm.
Proper, nice, not white ones, not little peregrine outdoor ones, really delicious tip-top peaches, because they can't get leaf curl.
No leaf curl,
because there's no rain.
Yeah.
And as long as you put bands of filthy black gunk around them and all that kind of thing and take all the leaves away now.
Peaches are very prolific if they're growing well and with a bit of cover to stop the peach leaf curl. You're right, it is extraordinary, isn't it? Growing them outside is much harder work. You
yes,
know, well, putting lean
I've got quite a big polytunnel. I haven't tried to, I mean, I have in the past tried to grow them outside and found it a bit frustrating, but in the poly, and I've kept them quite tight, I've made them into two little espaliers, and they're freestanding.
Espalier, because normally they grow them as fans, don't they?
Yes, but I wanted to keep growing things in the middle.
Right, so, right.
I mean, it's just the way it worked around the paths in there, but they're nice.
It sounds like you've got a mammoth polytunnel.
It's not that big, but it's big enough to do quite a lot of stuff in it. I don't think I'd have any more trees, probably, in it than that. Probably that's enough.
No, that's fascinating. So back to your meat side of your self-sufficiency there.
Yes.
Your lovely Herefords.
Yes, I've got, I mean, if you were to design the least economically efficient way of having miniature farming, this is where you could see it done, because I've got almost none of everything. So I've got five cows and some pigs and 20 sheep and some goats and chickens and all the different things, but all in uneconomically small lots.
Well, that's a mixed farm, isn't it? And and that is brilliant, isn't it? I think that's brilliant because you don't think they pay they don't think they pay their way.
I think they probably do just, yes, but
yes.
I don't think they might. But it is interesting. I mean, this place is 32 acres.
Right.
And then I use about another 35 for grazing and for making hay and stuff for my
neighbour.
Oh,
that's a fair bit of land.
But
yes.
If you were in, nevertheless, in England, that's not a farm, it's just a hobby. But if you were in Germany, or somewhere like that holding...
Or Holland.
Well, in Holland you'd be doing it more intensively.
Yes.
But in other countries, that counts as a farm, as it were. People are... They do another job as well, and, you know, those small-scale things work. We're not knowingly... I mean, we were talking about this earlier. We're not very well set up in Britain, I think, for how to turn stuff into ham or how to get it killed nearby or all those things is difficult to do because
all the legislations and things make it quite difficult now.
The overall feeling is basically against it. It's not that you can't do it all, but it is your. I mean, just the amount of, not that it's complicated, but just the amount of movement forms and filling forms, and somebody, lamb goes off somewhere and you've got to tell one person, a pig goes, you've got to tell someone else.
Yeah, and when you're only doing one or two a year, you forget how the system works.
Yeah, and then they come down and you're frightfully hard and say, why didn't you tell us? And you think, it can't matter that much, but of course it can.
They struck off two of my cows because I was late in registering.
No, they're I mean, they're right in a way, but it is definitely the case that if you've got 200 cows, then you're going to be doing that absolutely perfectly. And if you've got two, it's harder to remember to do it all the time.
But I think also that if you had the 50 acres in England and you were farming it yourself and you didn't employ anyone, I think you could then make a small living out of it, don't you think?
Yes, but I think that definitely what's the case is a kitchen garden is the most intensively farmed place in the world, or a polytunnel. And if you look at a field of wheat, it's the most incredibly unproductive kind of farming you could possibly imagine. You've got a field of an acre of ground, and okay, it produces 4 tons of wheat, and it's 200 to 800 quid's worth of wheat, whatever it happens to be. You have an acre of kitchen garden, and you're producing tons and tons and tons of everything, lots of which are really expensive non-commodity stuff. And if you do that very intensive work, the actual output of garden land for growing things is massive.
Yeah, but also when you get these hotels and things that do their own produce, and because they're producing it on small row scale as opposed to an acre of cabbages or 2 acres of this, it makes it very uneconomic, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also some things like cabbages are much happier in a field.
Well, really. They have to bang on so many insecticides to make them. I always remember the story of Miriam Rothschild telling me she used to feed her butterflies or caterpillars organic cabbages. And then one time she ran out and she bought some from the local greengrocers, fed them to the caterpillars, and they all died.
Yes.
You know, when you think how difficult it is to grow brassicas pest-free, if you grow them out in the open, you just have to shove on so much stuff to keep the whitefly.
Yes, earlier on thinking of other questions, one of the things I am intrigued by is why doesn't the bad weather kill whitefly? The whitefly seems to persist. I mean, maybe not because we've had very hard frost this morning, but all of last week, all the sort of Caballo Nero still had great sort of banks of whitefly underneath it.
I think they will grow, they'll go in this cold weather that will reduce them. Yeah. I mean, it was extraordinary with the oilseed rape and the flea beetle. Yeah. And then they stopped growing the oilseed rape. And the tractor driver was saying, you know, you would just be ploughing the soil and there'd be clouds of flea beetles coming up because they had nowhere to go.
Nowhere to eat. Good.
Good.
I'm pleased to hear it.
They're a real pest.
They're really annoying.
Since the rape's gone.
But they're annoying in the garden too because they eat radishes. You know, take a row of radishes away overnight and all that. I mean, literally, you get a row of any of those little brassicas later than the end of April and you rake the garden. And out come the little bugs, and a whole lot are gone in the morning.
Yeah, you have to cover it, don't you?
Yeah,
all the time.
Which is horrible to look at.
Mm. Yes, it is. There's just no way. Otherwise, your guests are eating slugs and snails.
I hope we didn't have too many. Yes.
No, they were very good.
Really tried to keep them to a bare minimum at lunch.
You want green ones so that the people don't notice them so much.
Or pink ones on the pink radicchio. You know, either way, you've got to keep colour coded. Mm. No, of course that's the case, and I'm very impressed at those hotels that do it. Because what I have found is, with my garden, I can feed myself and whoever's living here and some people coming for lunch and dinner. But if you're trying to regularly feed a whole load more, it's really hard to get enough of one thing.
50 covers of rocket even is quite difficult every day on the menu.
If you're doing it for the week, yes. Yeah. And you know, fennel, I love growing fennel. That's another good September.
Late one, isn't
really
it?
Late
it doesn't
one.
Bolt. When do you sow yours? August.
Really end of August. Yes. And it's fine because there's that sort of non-sowing moment, isn't there, for things like spinach and fennel. That's the bolting bit.
If you sow too early on in the summer.
You can do it really early in the spring and you can do it late in the summer, but there's a sort of gap where you just have to sit and do something different.
Yeah.
But the, you know, you think, how lovely a row of fennel, and you pick 12 because you've got people coming for dinner, and then you think, oh, they can't do that tomorrow. And then 2 days later, the whole row's gone. And so, yes, those places who are doing it really brilliantly, if they are, it's jolly impressive.
Yeah, very impressive, very difficult. I mean, I find that it's the picking that takes the most time in mine, really. Even just going out to pick everything takes more.
Picking flowers. We did. So Daisy, who works here, decided we would sell flowers at the end of the drive on Fridays after work.
Yes.
This summer. It was a great success. She had to pick 10, 15 bunches of zinnias and dahlias and nice, really nice big bright bunches and set up a table at the end of the drive and they were all gone in half an hour. It was really satisfactory, very good. She said pays for a day of her work. But we also worked out that picking the 15 bunches took ages.
Yeah.
You know, you pick them all the night before so they last and you make them all to bunches and wrap them up in the Financial Times and all the things that make them look nice. It's quite a lot of work. All the picking is slow.
Definitely is the most laboured part of my vegetable, I think, you know, pretty much. But no, it's lovely to see this. How do you see it in 10 years' time?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there were not only were there no garden, but there were really no trees here. And one of the things that you realise is that trees do nothing for ages, and then they suddenly really get going. Mm. And I've planted about 10,000 trees sort of an outer edge of here, and I think that whereas this still feels a little bit like a blasted heath with wind roaring across it, I think that there will be many more trees as a near background. So when you look over a wall, the moment you see clear blue sky, and I think you will see lovely foliage instead. And I think that that's, and with those, I remember watching East Ruston happening at the beginning in Norfolk and seeing the sort of shelter belts turning into nicer trees and them being able to be cut down a bit and all that kind of thing. And in the beginning, you can't believe trees will ever make any difference, but they change the temperature so dramatically and change the place, the feeling of it.
Wind chill factor is phenomenal, isn't it? Yes, I did that on moving in on April 1st. I planted them too late, 1,000 trees, but now the difference is phenomenal. And it beds a building into the landscape, doesn't it? Which is so lovely.
But I've got some trees coming next week. I just keep on doing it because I'm so pleased with the ones that. And I wish I'd done the ones that are coming next week 10 years ago as well.
Yes,
but
you
don't know really where you want to do it. But I think that will definitely change. Funnily enough, I don't think, I mean, the walls will cover up with fruit trees and things, and there are trees on the other sides of them. But I don't think I'm going to have loads of huge sort of topiary and things everywhere, except on that little yard in the front, because I think I do love the fact that the garden starts again each year. I love the fact that it's basically bare in the winter. Now we're not allowed to have it bare in the winter. We've got to cover everything with ghastly mustard everywhere, which I have obligingly done. Now I've covered all the mustard with muck instead. But I love the fact that you're starting with a blank canvas in the beginning of the spring, and then by the middle of the summer, the thing is a complete sort of wild riot of stuff that will also all go at the end of October. I find that quite...
The seasonal
I find
change.
That a thing. And and also, I don't do a huge amount of... I'm not mad for winter colour and things happening outside in the winter. I quite like the indoor stuff then and other outdoor stuff. And I'm happy to have a pause.
And you've got such lovely natural views of of the cattle and things like that from other windows, isn't it?
Yes. I mean,
this is tucked away. You don't see so much from the house, do you?
No. You do have to walk out here. But also, I think it's another thing with planning it. I mean, it's far be it for me to have a view on that. But I think that trying to work out what your walk around the garden is a really important bit of the plan. You know, what's the walk you do?
That's what King Charles always said when he planned his. Yes, he said he did it exactly that. And the vista, because he's a painter too, and the vista from each point that he went
round. It's really important. I mean, I totally agree with him. And I think that the business of, you know, where you walk through from one bit into another, how you align the gates, what you see through to, where you're going to go to next. And actually, that is what one's life's like. You get up in the morning in your gumboots and your dressing gown and a silly hat. And take the dogs out first thing in the morning.
It's a lovely image.
It's a pretty picture for you all.
Have you got one of those?
Again, another picture for radio. And you walk round and, you know, you have a track, you have a path that you draw around the place. And I think that working out what you're going to see out of that is, you don't actually see the garden as a ground plan. You know, that's not you don't experience it as a ground plan. You might picture it as that, but you see it as a walk. You go in one end of the greenhouse, out of the potting shed, up the stairs, past this, round that, through this gate, in the orchard. And I think those And you have varying lengths of walk, because you have the one where you wished you put your clothes on before you put the dressing gown on, which actually turns out to be way colder than you imagined. Or you have the one where you realise that you'd forgotten everybody's turning up and you still haven't quite got ready for the day or whatever. And so you have a short and a mid and a long.
Yes.
And I think that planning around that.
That's obviously the way artists see it, isn't it? I see it as a series of spaces, you see.
Not related to each other?
Related to each other, and obviously contrasting spaces, but that's how I tend to see the different spaces in a garden rather than a walk. Yes, it's just the way I come at it.
I don't know how different the effect is, but I think, I definitely also think that if you're a painter, you definitely do think of the view of it and what it would look like to see from one place to another. What's it look like looking through all these gates I made see through?
Yes,
because I think it's really nice to see through. I don't
glimpse.
Glimpse, exactly.
No, it's lovely. Well, thank you very much indeed. It's been lovely to see it.
It was really nice talking to you about it.
Lovely hearing about all your pottery and things. Next time I pick up a mug, I'll think of it differently.
You know, it started here.
Yes.